King Midas's Ears. You would think that Midas had learned his lesson by now, the lesson that repeats and repeats throughout the story of man. Don't mess with the gods, don't trust the gods, don't anger the gods, don't barter with the gods, don't compete with the gods, leave the gods well alone, treat all blessings as a curse and all promises as a trap. Above all, never insult a god. Ever. In one respect, Midas had certainly changed. He now spurned not just gold, but all riches and possessions. Shortly after Dionysus lifted the curse, he became a devoted follower of Pan, the goat-footed god of nature, fauns, meadows, and all the wild things of the world. With flowers in his hair, sandals on his feet, and the merest suggestion of clothing covering his modesty, Midas left his wife and daughter in charge of Phrygia and devoted himself to a hippy-happy life of simple bucolic virtue. All might have been well had not his master Pan taken it into his head to challenge Apollo to a competition to determine which was the superior, the lyre or the pipes. In a meadow one afternoon, before an audience of fauns, satyrs, dryads, nymphs, assorted demigods, and other lesser immortals, Pan put the syrinx to his lips. A coarse but likable air in the Lydian mode emerged. It seemed to summon barking deer, rushing waters, gambolling rabbits, rutting stags, and galloping horses. The rough, rustic tune delighted the audience, especially Midas, who really did worship Pan and all the frolicking mirth and madness that the goatfoot represented. When Apollo stood and sounded the first notes of his lyre, a hush fell. From his strings arose visions of universal love, harmony, and happiness, a deep, abiding joy in life, and a sense of heaven itself. When he had finished, the audience rose as one to applaud. Tmolus, the deity of the mountain, called out, "The lyre of the great lord Apollo wins." All agreed.
"Aye, aye,"
roared the satyrs and fauns.
"Apollo, Apollo,"
cried the nymphs and dryads. One lone voice demurred.
"No."
"No?"
Dozens of heads turned to see who could have dared dissent. Midas rose to his feet.
"I disagree. I say the pipes of Pan produce the better sound."
Even Pan was astonished. Apollo quietly put down his lyre and walked towards Midas.
"Say that again."
It could at least be said of Midas that he had the courage of his convictions. He swallowed twice before repeating,
I say the pipes make a better sound. Their music is more exciting, more artistic.
Apollo must have been in a soft mood that day, for he did not slaughter Midas on the spot. He did not peel the skin from him layer by layer, as he had done to Marsyas, when that unfortunate had had the temerity to challenge him. He did not cause Midas even the slightest amount of pain, but just said softly,
"You honestly think Pan played better than me?"
"I do."
"Well, in that case," said Apollo with a laugh, "you must have the ears of an ass." No sooner were these words out of the god's mouth than Midas felt something strange and warm and rough going on in his scalp. As he put an inquiring hand to his head, howls and hoots and screams and screeches of mocking laughter started to come from the assembled throng. They could see what Midas could not. two large grey donkey ears had pushed their way through his hair and were twitching and flicking back and forth for all the world to see.
"It seems I was right," said Apollo. "You do indeed have the ears of an ass."
Crimsoning with shame and mortification, Midas turned and fled the meadow, the taunts and jeers of the crowd sounding all the more clearly in his great furry ears. His life as a camp follower of Pan was over. Tying his head in a kind of turban, he returned to his wife and family in the palace of Gordium, and, his carefree experiment in country living decidedly over, settled back down into the life of a king. The only person who saw his ass's ears was necessarily the servant who cut his hair every month. No one else in Phrygia knew the terrible secret, and Midas was determined it should stay that way. "Here's the deal," Midas told the barber. "I give you a bigger salary and a more generous pension than any other member of the palace staff, and you keep quiet about what you have seen. If, however, you breathe a word to anyone, I will slaughter your family before your eyes, cut out your tongue, and leave you to wander the world in mute poverty and exile. Understood?" The frightened barber nodded. For 3 years, each side kept to the bargain. The barber's wife and family waxed fat and happy on the extra money that came in, and no one found out about the king's asinine auditory appendages. Turbans in the Midas style caught on throughout Phrygia, Thrace, Lydia, and beyond. All was well. But secrets are terrible things to have to keep, especially such juicy ones as that to which the royal barber was privy. Every day he would wake up and feel that the knowledge was writhing and swelling inside him. The barber loved his wife and family, and was in any case loyal enough to his monarch not to have any wish to humiliate or embarrass him. But that bulging, ballooning secret had to be somehow released before he burst. No unmilked cow with swollen udders, no mother of overdue twins, no gut-stuffed gastronome straining on the privy could ever feel such a desperate need for relief from their agonies than this poor barber. Finally, he hit upon a scheme which he felt sure would rid him of his burden without endangering his family. Awaking from a tortured night in which he dreamed that he had revealed the secret to the gaping populace of Gordium from a balcony in the main square, he went out at first light deep into the remote countryside. In a lonely place by a stream, he dug a deep trench in the ground. Looking about him in all directions to make sure that he was alone and that there was no possibility of being overheard, he knelt down, cupped his hands around his mouth, and shouted these words into the hole: "Midas has ass's ears!" Scrabbling frantically to close up the hole before the words could escape, he failed to notice one tiny seed floating down and settling at the bottom. When the backfilling was done, the barber stamped fiercely up and down on the earth to seal in the dreadful secret. He skipped all the way back to Gordium, headed straight for his favourite tavern, and ordered a flagon of the house's best wine. He could drink now without fear that the wine might loosen his tongue. It was as if he were Atlas, and the sky had finally been lifted from his shoulders. Meanwhile, over the next few weeks, back in the remote field by the stream, that tiny seed, warmed by the soft breath of Gaia below, began to germinate. Soon, a delicate little reed was shouldering its way through the topsoil and pushing its delicate head into the air. As the breeze caught it, the reed softly whispered, "Midas has ass's ears." The faint words reached the rushes and sedges that fringed the riverbank. "Midas has ass's ears." The susurration of rushes and the hiss of sedges was swept on by the grasses and leaves of the trees, and swiftly the soughing of cypresses and sallows sent the sound to the breeze. "Midas has ass's ears," sighed the branches. "Midas has ass's ears," sang the birds. And at last the news reached the city. "Midas has ass's ears!" King Midas woke with a start. There was laughter and shouting in the street outside the palace. He crept to the window, crouched down, and listened. The humiliation was too much for him to bear. Without stopping to wreak his vengeance on the barber and the barber's family, he mixed a poisonous draught of ox blood, raised his eyes heavenwards, gave a bitter laugh and a shrug, drained the drink, and died. Poor Midas. His name will always mean fortunate and rich, but truly he was unlucky and poor, if only he had kept to his roses. Green fingers are better than gold.